You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust. And this week we'll listen to a marvelous conversation between John Cage and Merce Cunningham about their decades-long collaboration. In the spring of 1981, during a residency at the Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, composer John Cage and choreographer Merce Cunningham sat down to discuss their work and artistic processes. As almost lifelong collaborators, Cage and Cunningham pioneered a new framework of performance. Their novel approach allowed for mediums to cohabitate within a performance, thus abandoning the centuries-long codependent model of dance and music. In Chance Conversations, an interview with Cunningham and Cage, the two discuss the methodology and motivations behind chance operations, a term used to describe artistic decisions based on unpredictability. Wanting to free himself of his likes and dislikes, Cage describes how Zen Buddhism influenced his work, leading him to use I Ching-inflected tools of chance. These new methods, adopted by both Cunningham and Cage, albeit with distinctions, overturned a whole foundation of thought around music, movement, and the process of creating art. We heard a brief excerpt of this interview in a program I did with dance writer and scholar Nancy Dalva that aired on All Things Cage on January 29th, 2022. But this week, in honor of Merce Cunningham, who would have turned 104 on April 16th, let's have a listen to it in its entirety. This interview, which was originally recorded on video, may be viewed in its entirety at Merce Cunningham Trust's YouTube channel. Cage and Cunningham's engagements together at the Walker Arts Center spanned nearly 30 years, with Cunningham's extending after Cage's death in 1992 to nearly his own death in 2009. His penultimate year, 2008, saw the site-specific installation in an enormous St. Cloud rock quarry of Ocean from 1994, a work conceived by Cage and Cunningham and realized after Cage's death by Cunningham in collaboration with David Tudor and Andrew Culver. Three amazing performances took place over September 11th to 13th, 2008, which you can read about at the walkerart.org website. The Walker Arts Center has continued its engagement with Cunningham's work, now long after Cunningham's death. Particularly noteworthy is the major exhibition, Merce Cunningham Common Time, taking place February 8 to July 30, 2017, and which closed with Tacita Dean's 2007 film installation, Stillness, a multi-screen work featuring the choreographer, then 90, performing John Cage's composition 433 from 1952. In keeping with its title, this exhibition was co-presented by the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago on February 11th to April 30th, 2017, sharing a common time across the two cities. Merce Cunningham, Common Time, was curated by Fionn Mead and Philip Byther with Joan Rothfuss and Mary Coyne. Featured were collaborations with such artists and friends, in addition to John Cage and Tacita Dean, as Tricia Brown, Jasper Johns, Morris Graves, Robert Morris, Bruce Nauman, Isamu Noguchi, Nam June Paik, Yvonne Rayner, Robert Rauschenberg, Frank Stella, David Tudor, Stan Vanderbeek, Andy Warhol, and many, many others. Far too much has taken place over the decades to encapsulate here, but our knowledge about Cage and Cunningham's time in history at the Walker Arts Center comes most recently from the work of Abby Sebele, Merce Cunningham Trust Fellow, who previously had worked on special projects at the Cunningham Dance Foundation. Abby has managed to unearth and share far more than was widely known before. You can peruse some of the archival jewels that Abby has uncovered by checking out the online Walker Art magazine, an article in particular entitled From the Archives, Merce Cunningham and the Walker, 1948 to 1969. Let's listen to Cage and Cunningham's conversation, after which I'll play something chance-determined from the beautiful box set of CDs, music from Merce, produced and released by New World Records in 2010. Enjoy.
Your collaboration together over the years has been quite unique in that it's a choreographer, dancer, and a composer, musician, putting together works, but they're not really related to each other. Could you talk a little bit, maybe Merce, you could start off, how this collaboration got started in the specific form that it's in?
It was in the middle 40s, and John had come to New York. I was already there, and we decided to give a program together, and for which I would make the dances and John would write the music. John had already talked about the idea of having a music which was not dependent upon the dance, nor the dance dependent upon the music, but which were separate identities which could, in a sense, coexist. And we worked at that time within something which he called a rhythmic structure. That is, we thought the common denominator between the two arts was time. And he had devised a form called rhythmic, which he called rhythmic structure, actually, within which we worked, which where we agreed upon certain structure points, but within those structure points, the time within the structure points, we were free to do as the dance went and as the music might go. And that was the more or less the first time that we began to work together, and then we've continued, and now the structure points in a way have disappeared, or it's a little bit like instead of going from Minneapolis to St. Paul, you go from Minneapolis to the moon, and there's a different thing about time.
It's less like an object and
more like the weather. Because in an object you can tell where the boundaries are, but in the weather it's impossible to say when something begins or ends. We hope that the weather will continue, and we trust that our way of relating dance and music will also continue. It's not starting from an idea, not starting even from an expression of the same feeling, nor an exposition of the same idea, but rather simply being together in the same place and the same time, and leaving space around each art, so that neither art has to glue itself to a particular. There are exceptions, of course. In Merce's solo tango, which was performed here yesterday, there are two points in the dance that we try to have the sound specifically related to. When he throws the towel down on the floor, immediately the loops which have been playing in my vocalizing stop, and the television begins. And then a half a minute later, when he comes to the front of the stage and points down, the television stops, and my drinking a cup of water with the throat microphone on starts. So that dance is not so much like the weather as it is a dance that has three parts. Or at least the music has three parts. Maybe you have more parts in the dance.
No, the dance is three. Three parts.
In general, though, you basically the only communication that you have with each other in doing the sound and in doing the dance is just a time frame. You just say, yes. It's going to be this amount of time. And
yes. That was the practice anciently in India. Instead of having two arts, dance and music, they had an art called Sangeeta, which was dance and music together. And they had a rhythmic structure which was called tala, but they improvised in that, in the talas. In the West, we've never had a, except perhaps in the Middle Ages, an idea about a theory of rhythm, so that it, that left it possible for us in this century to start thinking about time. And the more recently, in 1950, when the use of magnetic tape for musical purposes became generally usable, we began to see a close relation not only between movement and music, but between space and time.
Who normally provides the initiation for a dance and music piece? Do you, Merce, do you say that, okay, this piece is going to be 10 minutes long, and then John goes off and composes something and you do your dance?
We don't even state the time length.
Oh,
at
you
the
don't?
Beginning. No.
Often with the composer, he will ask the how long the dance is, and then if I know, I'll tell him. but if I'm working on it, I have perhaps an approximate idea of the time, but nothing specific, and so that even that is, can be left free. In other words, if he wants to know exactly, of course I will tell him. I'll tell him whatever he wants to know, but I try not to put anything in his way.
Because at the point where you're deciding that you are going to do a dance, you don't exactly know what it's going to be anyway.
And also, some of the dances that I make are so choreographed that they could, in a sense, go on and on. And I simply have to choose a point when I'm going to say, well, this is the end of this dance. Torse, for example, is in its entirety 55 minutes long. And the dancers have only done it once in an event, and that was enough. I wouldn't ask them to do it again. That was very difficult. And we ordinarily do it in three parts. The first part on one performance, the second part, and so on, the third part, the third section.
There was a misprint once in a criticism. I was at a pogrom, and the writer said that Tars was 55 minuets.
Do you work under the same kind of system, in that you're pretty much composing, but you're not really composing to a length, and then when the time comes where it has to be.
Well, when the curtain comes down, we stop the music.
Is that, that's really how?
That's how it happens, really, in the theater. Because no one, once the curtain comes down, no one wants to hear any more music. They've already begun applauding. I think the people are far more involved with their eyes than they are really with their ears. But the interesting thing about the ears is that you can hear things that are behind you.
That's true. Has it ever happened that in putting together an evening's event where there's a dance and music, or even you have other elements such as lighting and decor, that what you're presented with just doesn't seem to work with the dance, or that you don't like the way it sounds with the dance or looks with the dance? At that point, would you just let it go?
There was a time once with a piece where we had asked a painter to work with us, and he had made some interesting, what I thought were going to be interesting objects for us to use. In a sense, they were sketches. They weren't really sketches, but they were kind of ideas he showed me, and some were things sort of made up, half made up, and so on. I liked them very much, and we were going ahead with this, but when it came to the actual performance, he had changed his mind and made things which were much bigger, much more cumbersome and almost impossible to get on and off the stage, not just because of their size, but because that the actual stage space was such that there weren't any, the wings were difficult to get them in and out of, and that was a real problem. It was like a physical problem, which we couldn't simply couldn't surmount, and we eventually had to.
Was that David Hare?
No, it was Neil Jenny. It was a piece called Objects, and we did it not very often because it simply wasn't feasible to do. If we put the objects on the stages that we were playing at the time, then the dancers couldn't have gotten on the stage. There wouldn't have been enough room. And then we couldn't get the objects off because there wasn't enough room in the wings.
Did that dance just disappear then?
Of course. We simply couldn't deal with it.
You just didn't perform the dance at all?
Well, we did. Yes, we did it once or twice probably, but it simply wasn't possible to physically possible to deal with it. So we had to, so to speak, abandon it.
Could you describe a little bit, you work on a new dance for months and you work with your dancers in putting it together. Then when the piece of music is delivered to you, is it a revelation to you for the first time when the music and the dance are put together? I mean, is it ever disturbing to you? Do you generally like what happens? Do you like the idea that the effect of the dance can be somewhat modified by a different sound than maybe you had thought about in your head? Or
Yes, I think probably since I don't, now with our pieces, I don't hear the music before the public does at the first performance, nor do the dancers as far as that's concerned. So that there is a certain element of surprise that comes into this. And I'm also, mostly I hear it in the wings. If I'm not in the dance myself, I'm watching from the wings. And if it is, because it is a new piece, I'm usually so concentrated on the dancing to see that the dancers get along all right, because they themselves are nervous about the fact that it's a dance they haven't performed. So that I don't hear a lot of the music the first time. The dancers, I think, hear more than I do. If I'm in the piece, I'm likely to hear more, but in the wings, I'm so busy looking, and it's harder to hear backstage anyway, I think in general. But, yes, I've been surprised, and I've also been delighted. I think on the whole experience is toward the good side.
That's good. How about you, John? Do you feel similarly about your reaction?
I think it's lively and useful now in the society to be able to place one's attention not in just one way, but in two ways at least, like as with different music, different dance coming together. And then if we can go further than that and place our attention in three different directions, I think that would be even more interesting. And if we accomplish three, we could go on to four, to five, and so forth, so that we move toward a kind of complex use of our faculties that will suit us for our everyday life, which nowadays is coming toward us from all sides.
Do you think audiences have been affected at all by this?
Well, Merce was talking with someone from the theater at the university the other evening.
Oh, yes.
And he said that he felt that audiences that formerly had difficulty with our work because of the independence of the music and the dance in our theater, we're now beginning to be able to enjoy it. And that's to say, times change. And now that we're more or less on our last legs. The audience is beginning to sit up and enjoy itself.
Finally. That's great.
Maybe it'll continue for a little while.
Hope so.
I noticed that when Merce became 40, that the critics in London objected to his continuing to dance because they thought the dancers should be younger. But now that he's even older, no one seems to object any longer to the fact that that he dances.
Well, they don't voice the objection.
I think they're becoming interested in seeing how long this whole theater can last.
But you talked about the thing about the audience. The other last week we gave what we labeled an informal performance in St. Cloud on a rather, in a sense, a difficult stage for dancing because it was a recital hall stage and it was hard and so on. And the musicians were at the back and the dancers, we were in the front. And John made sounds by moving around the side. He slammed doors and moved
objects. The other musicians were doing electronic things.
And it was
I was doing what you call acoustic sounds.
Yes. But it was, and sometimes I was on the side when I wasn't performing. I was listening and looking at this and thought it was quite a fascinating event.
The doors that slammed were the loudest doors I've ever heard.
But the whole thing of the sound and the kind of sound being made and the fact that everything was visible, John was visible and the other musicians in the back and the dancers, and there were no wings. We would just go and stand on the side. So the whole thing became the theater, so to speak. And the
when the audience came in, everyone was warming up.
Yes, but for more than that, these are students, mainly a student audience. And sometimes when it's strange, as this might well be to them, they are likely to get up and depart and so on. And it was to go an hour, like the lunch hour, roughly like 1:15 to 2:15. And they were very attentive. It was a fair-sized audience, and they were very attentive to all this. And about 45 minutes after we started, a number left, but they all left at the same time, so I figured they must have class. So I thought, oh yes, that's all right. And the rest of the people stayed, and at the end of it, they had been absolutely silent, except for this time when the people left. The whole thing had been very, very quiet, and not they weren't restless or anything like this. They were, and it was clear to me that they were, we could see the public very easily because of the lighting. The lighting was so minimal. that they were absorbed by what was going on. They, whatever kind of judgments they were making, that doesn't matter. But while they were there, they were totally absorbed. And at the end of it, there was this very generous kind of applause to something that they had been involved with. And it's one of, well, this has happened several times, but this time was very noticeable to me because of the particular quality of the sound, the fact that the musicians were all visible, that we were all doing this in a very flat sense.
When you have the independence of the music and the dance that we have, then the observer becomes the third point in a triangle and does what Marcel Duchamp spoke of. He completes the work. And each triangle is a different triangle. If you are not involved with music, but are involved just with Zen Buddhism, and you want to free yourself from your likes and dislikes, you sit cross-legged, you know, and go through various breathing exercises. And if you don't do them properly, you get hit over the head. Well, I wasn't going to do that, but I wanted to adopt a discipline that would work in the field of music that would be just as strict as sitting cross-legged. And so I chose first to work with the magic square, and then later I came across the I Ching, and that a means of working with the tossing of three coins six times to get two numbers between 1 and 64. It struck me suddenly as being better than the magic square, that is to say, more generally useful. I think it's true because I began early in the 50s and I haven't found any reason to shift to some other way of working, though I include other means. I keep using those chance operations. Recently received, I was running out of printout because now I no longer toss the cards. I get a computer printout of the I Ching. And I recently received a million new numbers from the Bell Telephone Laboratories. Some people think I'm the slave of these chance operations, but I'm grateful to them, and think of them as a utility, or something like fresh air, or clear water.
Well, I use the chance operations too. I use the I Ching in certain pieces. Taurus, for example, is totally devised through using the numbers from the I Ching. I have to add certain things which still could be found out through the I Ching, but I use other kinds of chance things, like tossing coins and so on, to decide whether it's how many people are going to do a certain phrase, or whether it will be male or female, or so on. Those kinds of things. The use of chance is slightly different from piece to piece, depending on the, say, how many people are in the piece, the kind of piece it might be, how much time I have to do a piece. For example, I'm making one now, working on one with seven of the dancers, and I have a very short time to work at it, so that in using the chance operations, I have to use a rather broad use of it, rather than as detailed as I might do ordinarily, because I don't have that much time before we are to present the piece. But I've found in almost every piece I've done for years now that if I really use the chance operation and follow it through, that it always brings out something that I don't think I would have thought of otherwise by myself, and opens out some new kind of facet or new kind of possibility. I sometimes can't utilize it completely. That's simply because I don't have time enough with the dancers to bring it about perhaps as completely as I would like to. But I try always to start from some general chance operation and then detail it as much as I have time for.
That means that you do make some decisions even before you do the chance operation.
Well, there are also practical decisions always that have to be made that simply have to do with human beings. If you're suddenly on the floor and then at the next moment you're supposed to be high in the air, you have to do something in between. Now, technologically, you see, we could be there. As I explained to one of the students this morning, she asked this question. I said, well, with technology, you could be at one moment there and the next moment up. But without that, just by yourself, you have to somehow get up into that. But I take that as part of the human act, as part of the humanness of it, if I can put it that way.
John, do you ever make some decisions before you use the chance operation to sort of give it a structure before you even start?
What I try to do is to understand the field of possibilities in which the composition is going to take place. And then I ask questions which hopefully are radical questions that get at the roots rather than the surfaces of what will eventually happen. And then the answers come through the chance operations. I can rather quickly tell whether my questions have been radical or superficial, because the what happens then will be either like a door opening or like no door opening. And if no door opens, then the situation is superficial.
In talking, both of you have used a lot of analogies with nature and things like roots, plant life. Do you see a strong relationship between nature and the way that you two work together?
I would hope so, yes. I always liked that, those two paragraphs in the Lankavatara Sutra, when the Buddha was asked how enlightenment came. And in the first paragraph he said, well, it comes gradually. And he gave examples from nature, like the germination of seeds and other things that happen in nature gradually. And then without any explanation, he said, in the next paragraph, he said, it comes suddenly. And he gave examples from nature, like lightning and thunder, you know.
John, do you have you always had an overall interest in, well, moving out of strictly being a composer and working with a theater or with a dance company? What have been the benefits?
When I first wrote music and offered it to musicians, they didn't want it and had no use for it. And they said that wasn't the way to write music. When I showed the same pieces to dancers, they said, oh, I'll make a dance with that. They were very grateful for it. I think it's entirely because of my close connection through my life with dancers that my music has been used in the society. There was a year when I had the commission from the Boston Symphony to write one of the bicentennial pieces that I couldn't continue with the Cunningham Dance Company, and so I left the company for a year or so when they went to Greece and to Israel, some other places, to the south of France. And then I realized that it was such a large part of my life that something that was really missing when I wasn't there. So I've returned to the company. However, I noticed that I'm thinking of leaving again. It's because next year I'll be 70 years old, and there are so many arrangements, particularly in Europe and even in Japan, being made that I have to go to, that I doubt whether I'll be able to tour with the company and fulfill those other commitments at the same time. As it is now, I bring my work with me, and I get a good deal done. Because it's not really my life to perform my life is much more involved in discovering, if I can, something new that I haven't yet performed.
Have you felt that your work with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company has in any way revealed something to you about composing?
Yes, I'm working with Paul Zukowski now, the violinist, and I'm finishing, hopefully within at least 1 or 2 years more, the Freeman Etudes. And playing the violin is a complicated physical action that resembles dancing. And I've had to make what Merce was talking about just a few minutes ago, I've had to make certain compromises between the straightforward working of the chance operations and what is actually physically.
How do you get from one thing to another on the violin or on your feet?
So that I let the chance operations operate. And then with Zukowski, we find out what is feasible and what isn't. And we simply make those adjustments.
But don't you find with him sometimes?
We don't find any conclusive thing.
No, what I mean is that something that he might have thought was impossible, and then you try it out, and then it turns out to be possible.
That happens.
Yes.
But then another thing happens, and that is that he says, I could do this, but he had meanwhile learned to do that.
Yes.
And so we change it to this, and then in concert he reverts to what he originally knew. In the throw of physical action and the complexity of the situation, because the pieces are not easy, he does what first comes to mind, and frequently what comes to mind is what he had memorized in the first place.
Of course, yes.
And has nothing to do with the music.
No, that's what's sort of in the memory, yes.
Or in the muscles.
Yes, but muscle memory, that's what it is.
I get the feeling in listening to you that between the two of you in working as a choreographer and working as a composer, that even though there might be problems in reconciling certain things that you want to do, that they always do get reconciled.
Because there's always a way.
So to speak, the show must go on.
But there always is a way. Somehow, if you just keep at it long enough, you find some way to deal with it.
We've been listening to Chance Conversations, an interview with Cunningham and Cage that took place at the Walker Arts Center in 1981. As promised, I've selected something by Chance from the New World Records box CD set, Music for Merce. And what's come up is Spectra from 1989 by the late Japanese composer Takehisa Kosugi, who from 1977 performed as a musician with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. He succeeded David Tudor as music director in 1995. Kosugi died in 2018 in his native Japan. Spectra was used for the dance called Cargo X by Merce Cunningham. Kosugi performing on live electronics, percussion with contact mics and voice. David Tudor and Michael Pugliese, live electronics and percussion with contact mics. Enjoy.
No! Oh! preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.